strong national defense. Having learned the lesson, the best way to avoid battle is to prepare for it. Thank y'all very much for allowing me to come speak to y'all today.
I'm noted for my hosiery.
Worst things to be noted for?
Well, if you have to wear a blue suit, you might as well take a little risk.
Thank you.
All right, are we ready to go? Well, Governor, I would like to exercise the host prerogative and ask a couple of follow-on questions before we open it up to everybody else. That was an extraordinarily strong and stark speech, and I'd sort of like to pick our way through a couple of the issues, if I may. First of all, to talk about American leadership. Second of all, to sort of think about what a rebuilding of America's military would look like. And then we have to talk a little bit about the politics of the issue.
Okay?
And I'd like to do this sort of in the... by casting our minds ahead a couple of years from now. You gave a very chilling assessment of where we are today, but it's easy to see that things are in fact likely to be worse when the next president takes office, both in the international arena, if the budget cuts and withdrawal of our forces from various regions continue, and then, of course, in the context of what's likely to be a hard-fought election campaign. So why don't we start with the question of leadership, and again, imagine where we'll be in 2 years and ask ourselves what the task for a president might be in January 2017. Could be an even steeper uphill climb than the one you described in your speech.
I think you're right. We'll have 2 more years of this president's dangerous policies, not just rhetoric, but policies. We'll have 2 more years of disengagement, America's disengagement from the world, 2 more years of America leading from behind. I think for the next administration, the first task will be to rebuild, and I want to emphasize it was a bipartisan post-Cold War consensus. I am a conservative Republican, but this shouldn't only be a Republican imperative. This is an American imperative to first rebuild that strategic consensus that understands America cannot lead from behind. America cannot disengage from the world, that America is the indispensable nation, to restore that belief in American exceptionalism. I truly believe this is the first president that I can remember. I certainly think the first president that does not believe in American exceptionalism. So even before the budget changes and the defense buildup, I think there needs to be a change in our strategic positioning vis-a-vis our allies and our enemies, but it has to be backed up by the investments. A new strategy without the investments, without the investment in the military, will ring hollow. I think that the new administration, supported hopefully by a bipartisan majority in the Congress, will take the steps to increase the investments in our military for things like readiness, for things like the modernization. Now, I say as a guideline we should get to 4% of GDP. I think it needs to be informed by threats analysis. I don't think that we simply give the Pentagon a blank check, but at the very least, I think we can start by going back to the Secretary Gates baseline. It was the last time there was a comprehensive and a consistent threat analysis done with a realistic, not just a political number, to undergird the defense, the military establishments, the Pentagon's needs. We owe our men and women in uniform the tools, the readiness, the training they need to keep us safe. One of the growing realizations, and hopefully this is a bipartisan realization, is that our oceans don't keep us safe. We face asymmetrical threats. We face threats from transnational terrorist groups. We face threats from nations that can now threaten us through cyber warfare, through biological warfare. And therefore, we're going to have to have the commitment over the long term to deter and defeat these threats. I do think the world is hungry for American leadership. I think that our allies are hungry for that leadership. It will take time to rebuild our credibility so that our enemies fear us and our allies trust us. But I think a new administration supported by a bipartisan majority in Congress can take some decisive steps fairly quickly to begin rebuilding that role. The reality is no other country can fill the vacuum we have now left on the world stage.
Just to push it one step further, I mean, the vacuum is really enormous in scope. A couple of years ago, nobody could imagine the peace of Europe being at risk. People have underestimated, I mean, we talk about people underestimating ISIS's capability and willpower. We have consistently underestimated China's ambitions and its capabilities. And then to return to the Middle East, which has not been a happy place, but even if we compare it to where we were in 2009, it's pretty easy to see that it's worse than it was then. And you may, or the next president may, inherit a war with ISIS that's incomplete and not heading in a positive direction. Mm. How do we, is it even possible to prioritize among these interests, or is it just simply necessary to take the steps that would get us back on the path to success in all places?
Well, look, I do think we need to take a comprehensive approach, but I would identify three challenges that I think are of particular concern and alarm. Short term, obviously, we are in a, and I know the president doesn't like to use these terms, we are in a war with ISIS. They've declared war on us, and whether he wants to call it that or not, that is a fighting conflict. We need to win that. Okay. We need to exterminate ISIS. This is not about containing them. It's not about expelling them. It's about hunting them down and killing them. Obviously, we've got to complete that effort. And one of the things I say in my longer paper is that America must prepare our defense forces not just to be able to win wars, but to decisively win wars, to act as a deterrent against future conflict. Secondly, the thing that concerns me the most, the greatest concern on the short-term to medium-term horizon, is the lessons that Iran must be taking from America's failure to lead these last few years. The world cannot accept a nuclear-armed Iran. That is not only an existential threat to Israel and our other allies in the region, that's a threat to the United States as well. I worry, almost a year ago now, the United States, we announced this reprieve with Iran. We've seen no meaningful follow-through, no meaningful action since that time. They're only strengthening their abilities, only hastening the day to which they will become a nuclear power, and the time for us to take decisive actions are running out. So the second concern I've got is, what are the lessons Iran is taking away from America's lack of decisiveness, America's weakness under this administration? The third, and you mentioned this, and I mentioned this also in the longer paper, I actually think the president's pivot towards Asia was at least the shell of a good policy. I think the president was right to announce our intentions. Unfortunately, it wasn't followed up by the actual resources to do anything about it. When you look at the growing strength of China, I think that is, in the medium term, the rising threat. You've got China now who wants to exercise more influence in its region. You've got many countries, including allies like South Korea and Japan, looking to American leadership. You've got countries that were non-aligned like India, and you've got other countries, even like Vietnam, that are looking to American leadership and willing to join with America, under America's leadership. But unfortunately, rhetoric's not good enough. The president did a great job giving a speech about pivoting our attention and putting more resources there. But without the investment, without the actual resources to follow it up, it's going to ring hollow, and those countries aren't going to follow unless we actually follow through. You talked about Europe. An example of that is when you look at Russia going. So those are the three in terms of the if you had to prioritize. But I think there are comprehensive. I do think this is a situation where if America is serious about investing in our military, if America is serious about backing up our rhetoric with those resources, you will see a safer world. And I think the opposite is true. The more we withdraw from the world, the more chaos there is going to be all over the world and unpredictable challenges as well. You'd mentioned, I think this is very telling, Europe is no longer, you're right, it is hard to believe how quickly Europe has gone from where it was post-Cold War to where it is today. It's no coincidence that Putin is in the Crimea, that he is threatening Ukraine. I think he looked back to 2009, he looked back to the infamous reset with Russia, he looked to the unilateral withdrawal of the interceptors, he looked at what happened, our treatment of Georgia and their desire to quickly join NATO, and he took note of this president's weakness. Now, we still could secure Europe. We could still deter, I think, Russia if we were willing to put brigades in allied countries in Eastern Europe, if we were willing to work within that framework. But if we don't have the resources to do that, if we don't have the manpower, if we don't have the resources to effectively deter Russian aggression, I think Europe becomes more dangerous, less stable, rather than the other way. But it's not inevitable. The chaos we're seeing is not inevitable. It is the absolute predictable fruit from this administration's disengagement, weakness from trying to lead from behind.
You mentioned the gap between our strategic needs, our traditional posture in the world, and the resources available. That's another hole that we've dug that hasn't bottomed out yet, if I can extend the analogy. You mentioned cutting the C-17 and the F-22. That's just the tip of the iceberg. Part of the problem is that there's very little or few modernization programs left to invest in. There's been a big enthusiasm for inventing new things, but the photon torpedoes haven't even made it into the laboratory yet, let alone to the field. Can you imagine another sort of, you know, Reagan-like buildup being necessary in the next administration?
Absolutely, and I'd say two things. We absolutely are not saying, we're not calling for getting to 4% of GDP overnight. For example, if you did that in 2012 numbers, you'd be looking at approximately an $80 billion increase. I don't think the Pentagon's capable of spending that money well, even if we were to give them that money today. So I absolutely think that we're talking about ramping this up over the short term, over a number of years. But we also, one of the things that we also call for is changing our procurement process. We've got to develop and deploy technology much more quickly. Our goal should be a 7-year window. Otherwise, even with the F-22, even with some of the modernization programs that have been suspended or even canceled, we've seen by the time it has taken so long to develop and deploy technology, by the time it's deployed, it's already obsolete. And so I am calling for more investment in the Pentagon, in our forces, in our technology, but also talking about changing the procurement process. So we cut down the bureaucracy within the Pentagon to get projects approved so it doesn't go through 100 different meetings. We also need more accountability so it's not dispersed through so many offices so that nobody has accountability. I'm also calling for multi-sourcing components of programs, and again, speeding up that delivery and holding folks accountable for delivering on time, on budget. But I want to be very clear. There is waste and abuse, and we have to root it out, because that waste and abuse is leaving our forces less prepared and leaving our forces without the readiness, without the training, without the equipment they need. Waste and abuse is not enough, and that shouldn't be an excuse for disinvestment in the Pentagon, in our military forces, in defending our nation. So, yes, let's root out the waste and abuse. Yes, let's shorten the procurement cycles, reform the acquisition process. But that's not an excuse for disinvesting in our military and leaving our men and women without the training, without the resources they need. We absolutely, as we reform the procurement process, have to increase the investment. And we do point to the Reagan buildup as an example, a successful example, not only the buildup of military hardware, but also investment in our forces, but at the same time also deploying the soft power tools available to an administration. Under the Reagan administration, they did support the democracy, the freedom movements in Eastern European and other countries. And you saw great things happen, not only for our national interest, but for world stability and peace. You won the Cold War, famously, as Maggie Thatcher said, without ever firing a shot. We had a hollowed-out military post-Vietnam. Unfortunately, we've got a hollowed-out military. We're getting a hollowed-out military again thanks to this administration's neglect and disinvestment in our military.
My last question, I promise, and then we'll open it up. But since you're actually a practicing politician, and I would be remiss to let this moment go by. We've been told for the past 6 or 7 years that we as a nation are weary of war, and what under any circumstances we would never, ever deploy ground forces. I was struck last week by an NBC poll, not exactly, you know, take it for what it was. At any rate, in that poll, the question framed was, if recommended by the military, would you agree with the deployment of ground forces in the war against ISIS? 45% total Americans said yes. 63% of Republicans said yes. And 66% of people who identified as Tea Party members said yes. Of course, 32% of Democrats said yes. Do you think, at least within the conservative universe, the politics of these issues are shifting?
Three things. One, look, I don't think there's any American that ever wants to go to war as a first choice. I don't think there's any American in either political movement or party, conservative, liberal, whoever you call yourself, that wants to use ground troops as a first choice or the military as a first choice. And ironically enough, the point we make is that a stronger military, the best way to avoid war is to prepare for it, is to have a stronger defense, have the tools, that peace through strength is better than war through weakness. Secondly, however, I think it's very foolish for this president to unilaterally announce what we're not going to do. He seems inclined every time there's a challenge to go out of his way to tell people what we won't do as opposed to telling them what we will do. So I thought it was very foolish to announce unilaterally to ISIS that we will not deploy ground troops. And he does this again and again. Nobody was arguing that we needed to lead with ground troops, but to take these options off the table unilaterally seems to me to be a very foolish way to deter our enemies and to win the peace. The third point to your question about the poll results, look, I think the American people have showed time and time again, not just in our recent modern history, but decade after decade, through the Cold War, through two world wars, and challenge after challenge, the American people are willing and wanting to rise to the challenge when they trust their leadership, when they feel like that there is effective leadership that is leading us to protect our nation's vital interests. I think there is overwhelming bipartisan support to defend our nation, our vital interest. And again, I think you'll see that whether it's against ISIS or any other threat we face as a country. I am a conservative Republican. I've said this before, but this should be a bipartisan consensus. It was a bipartisan consensus post-World War II, throughout the Cold War, and it should be so again. There should be a bipartisan consensus. My hope is that there are responsible leaders in both parties, in the Congress, as well as across the country, that will stand up and say, this is vital to protecting America's interests here and abroad, to securing the homeland. You know, our federal government is now doing many things our founding fathers never intended. And when the government tries to do everything, it doesn't do its core responsibilities well. The first and most important responsibility of our federal government is to secure the homeland, to secure our nation. It's in the Constitution. The one thing the federal government is actually ordered to do, the one thing that Congress has actually told it must do, is to secure our country. We're living now at a time where, and this is remarkable, we're now living at a time where the government is spending a record share of our economy in the last few years. At the same time, we are spending a record low amount actually defending our country post-World War II. For the last 70 years, now think about that. We're spending more of our economy on the government. At the same time, we're spending less to defend our country. I think the American people understand we have got, the federal government's got its priorities backwards. Whatever you think about the role, size, or scope of government, the first and most important responsibility of government is to actually defend our country. And by the way, it is more effective, and it is better for us to do so ahead of time, not only in terms of blood and treasure, but in terms of the danger and threats to our country, than to try to lead from behind and lead through weakness.
Okay, we've got about 10 minutes for questions. I'm going to begin. Dov Zakheim caught my eye first, and I know he will observe the AI rules of waiting for the microphone, announcing his name for the transcript, and putting his statement in the form of a question. So, Dov.
No, this isn't a statement.
Tough place.
Okay, Dov Zakheim, spelled Z-A-K-H-E-I-M, okay? The elephant in the room when you talk about spending more on defense, and it wasn't something I had to face when I was in charge of the defense budget in the early 2000s, is the sequester. And in fact, Leon Panetta, who's really a straight shooter, complains that when he argued against the sequester, he had nobody to back him up. Presumably, if there's a change in a couple of years, we will fight to get rid of the sequester. Do you see any possibility of doing that before the next 2 years are up?
I think we should absolutely do everything we can. Obviously, a lot will depend on the November elections. I'm hopeful that Harry Reid will be retired as majority leader, and I'm hopeful that Nancy Pelosi will not be returning as speaker. But I absolutely agree with the premise of your question that the sequestration when it comes to defense cuts were an absolute mistake. Added on top of President Obama's own reductions to the Secretary Gates baseline, then you added the impact of sequestration on defense, you've got nearly a $1 trillion reduction to what was the last responsible assessment of what the Pentagon actually needed. And Secretary Gates didn't propose, I would argue he didn't go far enough in his proposal, but I am saying that was the last time there was a reasonable threat analysis. It's just remarkable to me that the president would, in the space of a speech, simply throw out his own secretary's work and pick an arbitrary number, a political number, and then on top of that, Congress would impose arbitrary reductions on top of those arbitrary reductions. I think it was a mistake for Republicans to accept sequestration cuts in defense. I think we do need to allow the cuts in the other portion of the federal budget continue. We need to continue to shrink government, in my view. When it comes to defense, I think these sequestration cuts in defense were a mistake. I think if they were honest, even the administration would admit that they played a bad game of chicken with the nation's defense, and we all lost because they put what they thought and knew to be bad policy on the table for political reasons. And I think that was I think it's irresponsible to play with when you think that it's the men and women in uniform who will suffer first and suffer the most. They're the ones who are now going to be tasked with missions without the resources. It is simply irresponsible to send them on missions without the tools they need to successfully complete those missions. So absolutely, we need to undo the sequestration impacts within the defense, within the Pentagon portion of the federal budget.
All right, I'm going to identify the young woman hidden behind the...
Thank you for your terrific targeted speech, Governor Jindal. Elizabeth Sinclair, regular citizen. Millions of Americans, many of whom were worried about Obama's MO from the start, believe President Obama is effectively waging soft war against the United States himself. Should we be lucky enough to survive two more years of these clear and daily dangers, what arsenal tools do concerned, if not terrified, Americans have?
I'm sorry, which tools?
What kind of arsenal tools?
Sure. Well, look, a couple of things. One, I think that I would encourage everybody that's concerned to be active this November. We can't wait 2 years. We need to start taking our government back, and we can do that best right now through these elections right ahead of us. I will say this. I've been a vocal and persistent critic of this administration's policies on a number of areas. I called for the repeal and replacement of Obamacare. I'm suing the Federal Department of Education over Common Core as a breach of the 10th Amendment to the Constitution. I called the Eric Holder lawsuit against our school choice program hypocritical, cynical, and immoral. I called for Eric Holder to be removed from office over Fast and Furious. And I could go on. The point is I'm not a fan of this administration. There's a reason I don't get invited to the Obama White House for dinner. But I will say this, and I've been very... very specific in my concerns about the threats facing our country, and I believe those to be true. I'm still an optimist about the future of our country. I still believe in my bones this is still the greatest country in the history of the world, and despite the challenges we have seen under this administration, I think it's still within our reach for this generation to renew those principles of freedom. I don't think it's inevitable that America remains the greatest country. I don't think it's somehow etched in our DNA or there's something magical. I think it's wonderful we're blessed with resources and the oceans and all these other great things, but that doesn't make us inevitably great. I think the founding fathers got it right when they trusted us with freedom in the founding documents and put it into not only our political DNA, but into our culture. I think our 40th president was right, though, that every generation has to choose for itself to renew our principles of freedom. I think this is our generation's turn in time. So I think it is up to us. So I would, as a word of encouragement, I'm frustrated. I think the world is a more chaotic place. To your litany of regions, there's not one point in the world you can point to and say it's become safer or better since this administration took office. And remember, this was the administration, I remember the oceans were supposed to be healed. I remember we were supposed to reset relations. The world was going to love us. He went and gave a speech in Cairo that was going to solve everything. And instead, the world has become a much more chaotic, much more dangerous place. But I don't want the American people to become so frustrated or despondent to think that, well, our best days are behind us. I don't think that's true. I think this is a great country. I think it's still within our grasp to renew those principles of freedom. I think we've got work to do on the world stage. I'd also say we've got work to do here at home. And to me, that talks about restoring the American dream, to remind folks through our policies and through our rhetoric, the American dream is not about government dependence, not about redistribution. It's not about taking from others. It's about equality of opportunity, not outcomes. And that's another speech for another day, but I think one of the most dangerous things this president has done at home has been to try to redefine the American dream. And I think we've got great work to do there, restoring the American dream here at home. But the good news is, I think it's still doable. My parents came to this country nearly 50 years ago in search of the American dream. I think that dream is still possible for their grandchildren, but I think we've got work to do to ensure that it remains possible for their children and all of our children and grandchildren.
I'm going to go to the back of the room. The gentleman who's been standing up needs to be rewarded for his endurance, if nothing else.
Mitch Muncy with the Hamilton Society. Is it imaginable that we will have the resources to reach and maintain 4% GDP investment in defense without some pretty uncomfortable reform of entitlements?
A couple of things. One, first half of your question, we absolutely have the resources because, to my mind, we've got to fund defense first. To my mind, you fund defense first with the commitment, the resources it takes. And again, the guideline is 4%, but it's based on a strategic analysis. That doesn't mean it's an automatic 4% on autopilot. It needs to be informed. But if we're consistently underinvesting over a period of time, that should be a warning flag. But we need to put aside those resources first. That's the federal government's first responsibility. Then we decide what else we can afford to do as a country, because our federal government's first and most important obligation is to defend our country. To the second half of your question, I think we've got to reform our entitlement programs separate and apart from what we have to do in a defense. The reality is the entitlement programs are not sustainable on their current trajectory. What did this president do when he came into office? He simply added another entitlement program to the ones we already have, when we can't already afford to do what we have promised we were going to do today. And I think to maintain the promise of our entitlement programs, specifically Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, for future generations, to keep the promise, we do have to reform and strengthen and improve those programs. Through America Next, we shared a program on healthcare reform that specifically talks about some of the things that we can do in Medicare and Medicaid in particular. So absolutely, we need to reform those entitlement programs. That's even separate and above and beyond what has to be done in defense. That's simply to make sure we can maintain the promises we've made and to make sure we strengthen and improve those programs for future generations. And that's simple math. You listen to the nonpartisan actuaries of those programs, especially Medicare and Social Security, and they'll tell you those programs, especially when you look at the Medicare Part A Trust Fund, just as one example, will run out of resources before we finish paying for the health care benefits to the baby boomers and others that are entering that program. So absolutely, we need to reform the entitlement programs. I was the ED on the National Bipartisan Commission on the Future of Medicare back in the 90s, and there was a bipartisan proposal supported by Republicans and Democrats, including groups like the DLC and the Wall Street Journal and the AMA, behind a version of premium support. So I think it's possible to do it in a bipartisan way, to reform those programs, to strengthen them for future generations. So absolutely, yes, we need to reform those programs, but that's true regardless of whether people agree with me or not about the need to invest in defense.
Oh, my goodness. All the time is gone. I'm very sorry about that, because this was a very important conversation, Governor. I think it'll be our job to try to get you an invite to the White House so you can give the Commander-in-Chief some advice that he very dearly needs.
But apparently it's not that hard to get in now.
Well, so. Yeah, right. Only if you're carrying a weapon, I think. but failing that, our doors here are always open too. So thanks for joining us, and thanks everybody.
Thank you to the people at AI. Thank y'all very much for having me.
How are you?
Members of the press, we'll be back in
And now, our continuing campaign 2014 coverage continues with the second debate for the Iowa U.S. Senate seat. Democratic Congressman Bruce Braley is facing Republican State Senator Joni Ernst. Current U.S. Senator Tom Harkin is retiring after five terms. Both the Cook and Rothenberg political reports list this race as a toss-up. This is live coverage on C-SPAN.
Send super PACs pumping millions into this contest.
Joni Ernst is with us.
But Congressman Braley voted against your rights.
Hoping to win one of the most hotly contested races in the nation.
Because I'll go to Washington as a mom, a soldier.
I'll work with anyone who will help solve the tough problems that we face.
Ad campaigns making national headlines.
Let's make them squeal.
Joni Ernst's ads are hard to forget, but her record just doesn't cut it.
All to win a key seat, long held by a Democrat and now up for grabs. Republican State Senator Joni Ernst taking on four-term Democratic Congressman Bruce Braley. It is still too close to call. Tonight, head-to-head, as the country watches, this is Decision 2014, debate for Iowa's next senator. And you are looking live at the audience in the Galvin Performing Arts Center on the campus of St. Ambrose University in Davenport, Iowa. They and the thousands of you watching across Iowa and across this nation are waiting to hear from candidates in the hottest, closest Senate races in United States history, one that many experts say may determine control of the U.S. Senate. Congressman Bruce Braley and State Senator Joni Ernst locked in a dead heat for the seat of retiring Senator Tom Harkin. The winner will be Iowa's first new senator in 30 years. So, over the next hour, they will be questioned by our panel of journalists, each with decades of experience in Iowa, in a format aimed at giving the candidates the chance to answer questions in depth, while allowing the reporters to probe even deeper into their answers. From KWQC TV 6 News, I'm Gary Mativier, moderator of this debate. A coin flip determined who will get the first question, and that will be Bruce Braley. And we begin with a question from social media. The Quad City Times, T.A. Rosa writes, I am sick and tired of politicians skirting the issues and not providing plans as to how they attack issues rather than their opponent. I want results-oriented politics, not the ideology of dividing and then blaming the other side. The problems facing American families today will require the best ideas from everyone to solve. How will you work across party lines, and how should the people of Iowa measure your progress? 1 minute, please.
Thank you, Gary. I want to thank the Quad City Times and KWQC for hosting us tonight here at St. Ambrose. And I want to thank everyone watching here tonight and watching on television. Thank you, Senator Ernst. Great question, Rosa. And I am sick and tired of politicians who won't work across the aisle, too. I'm here tonight to talk about my proven record of doing just that. 8 years of working with anyone who's got a good idea that's good for Iowa, and I've got a proven record to back it up. The first bill I introduced was to create a job training partnership program in renewable energy through Iowa community colleges. I worked with a Republican from Alabama to make that become law. I worked with Republicans from Minnesota to get benefits for the Iowa National Guard after they were denied them by the Pentagon. I worked with a Republican senator from Utah so that government agencies communicate more clearly and effectively with you and people like you. And I worked to make sure that an Iowa manufacturer continued to make a product here in the United States instead of sending that product overseas. I will continue to work with anyone who's got a good idea that's good for Iowa. That's my track record, and that's my commitment to you.
Thank you, Senator Ernst.
Yes, thank you. Thank you to our hosts tonight. Thank you, Congressman Braley, for joining me on this stage. And as the President had stated last week, this November, this fall, his policies are on the ballot. And we see that now that Congressman Braley has voted 95% of the time supporting Nancy Pelosi and the President's agenda. We have seen those failed policies nationwide. But what we have seen here in Iowa, reforms, utilizing Terry Branstad and his great ideas. We have come up with transformational mental health reform, education reform, the largest tax cut in Iowa history, and all of this was done by bipartisan support, working together. Great successes here in the state of Iowa. We need to take these ideas in Iowa, our great bipartisanship, to Washington, D.C. That's what I will do.
Thank you both. And as we delve into the issues, as we begin with environmental issues tonight, please consider the concerns of science teacher and parent Glenn Kayla, who wants to know your plan to reduce and eventually completely eliminate our dependence on fossil fuels for energy. Our first question regarding the environment will be from KWQC Marsha Lenz, directed toward Congressman Bruce Brake.
Thank you. First, I would like to say that I am very pleased that you have both agreed to this debate. I think that it is important that voters be allowed to choose their candidate based on direct information rather than advertising. So thank you again. I do want to start with environmental issues for our discussion, and I'm beginning with Congressman Braley. You have changed your stance on the XL pipeline. It would carry oil from tar sands in Canada through the Midwest to U.S. refineries. Supporters say that it would promote oil independence in North America and also create jobs. So what is your position on this form of energy infrastructure?
My position is very clear, Marcia, and it's also important to Glenn, who's teaching students about the environment. I oppose the Keystone Pipeline, and it's very simple. When the pipeline was first proposed and we were first asked to vote on it, a lot of promises were made about what was going to happen with the oil produced in that pipeline and the jobs it was going to create. But the more I looked into it and the more I talked to Iowans, the more I became convinced there was no guarantee that the oil produced and sent through that pipeline was going to stay here in the United States and benefit U.S. consumers. And there was no guarantee that a lot of good-paying jobs would be created for Iowans. My energy priorities are to make sure that it reduces our dependence on foreign oil, that it reduces the cost of energy, and it creates good-paying jobs in Iowa. I've stood with Iowa's biofuels and wind energy producers against the big oil interests who are supporting the Keystone Pipeline. And Senator Ernst stands with them. They're among her biggest supporters, and that's a big difference between us in this debate.
Then, State Senator Ernst, you were quoted saying that you would shut down the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency created in 1970, signed by a Republican president, to curb air pollution and later monitor water quality. Do you really want to shut down the EPA, and if so, why?
I am a young woman who grew up on a Southwest Iowa farm drinking well water. My father is a farmer, and our farmers are some of the best conservationists out there. So I do believe that our states know best how to protect their natural resources. I believe this can be done at the state level rather than at a national level with the federal EPA. There are many great acts out there. The Clean Water Act is a good one, but unfortunately, over the course of time, the EPA has overreached. And a great example of this is when they proposed a rule that would allow the EPA to come onto farmers' lands and dictate to them how they manage the water on that land. Now, Bruce Braley supported that overreach with the EPA because he is being backed by California environmentalist Tom Steyer. He stood with the EPA over our Iowa farmers.
Marcia, that's not true. I voted to prohibit the EPA from regulating ditches and farm ponds, and Senator Ernst knows that. She has stated that she supports the environment, but sound bites have consequences. And when you say that you would vote to repeal the Clean Water Act, you're saying that you don't want Iowans to have clean drinking water. And when you say you want to repeal and get rid of the EPA, which was created by a Republican president, you're saying that you don't want anyone making sure that the air we breathe is clean, the water we drink is pure. Those words have consequences that are harmful to Iowans. And Senator Ernst knows that, and that's why she's supported by the Koch brothers and big oil backers who want to get rid of those rules.
We will talk about your supporters in a block coming up in just a moment. But would you like 30 seconds to rebut?
Yes, I would love to rebut that. No, I do believe in a clean environment. And I drive a hybrid car. My family recycles. I encourage recycling at every opportunity. But I believe the federal government shouldn't be overreaching with rules and regulations that are killing our industry here in Iowa and nationwide. We need to make sure that any rule or regulation is reasonable and still protects our environment. We can do that, but not with the significant overreach that we're seeing from the federal government right now.
Thank you. Marcia, did you have a follow-up?
If you are suggesting that the states regulate as opposed to a federal agency, how does the state have the wherewithal, the power to be able to regulate a company that may not be based within the state, or another state maybe has the jurisdiction? How do you do that without doing it on the federal level?
Senator Ernst, 30 seconds, please.
Yes, Marcia, thank you. The states can do that by working together. Now, we can eliminate or reduce the size of the federal government's involvement with the EPA. There are other regulatory agencies that can step in. But again, the states need to have control over what's going on within their state. And so much of that power has been taken away from the states and is being focused at the federal government level. We have our own environmental protection commissions that best know how to preserve our natural resources within the state.
Marcia, the reason a Republican president created the Environmental Protection Agency is because states couldn't prevent big polluters from destroying our planet. And that's why when President Nixon created it, there were rivers on fires and the cities were clouded with pollution. That's why Richard Nixon created the Environmental Protection Agency. The father of federal conservation was a conservative Republican from Oskaloosa, Iowa, named John Lacey. This isn't a partisan issue. It's an issue that is important to Iowans because Iowans are the one harmed.
Thank you. Now let's get to our next reader question from the Quad City Times. And this will begin with Senator Ernst for 1 minute. Charles Collins from Bettendorf is a new enrollee under Obamacare. He's heard Joni Ernst say that she would work to repeal it. He asked, have you given any thought to how individuals in my situation won't lose coverage should the repeal occur? And Randy and Ellen of Clinton say his employer dropped coverage because of Obamacare, and he asked, what do you tell the people who lost their health insurance because of Obamacare?
Every Iowan and every American has the right to affordable quality health care, but Obamacare is not the answer to that. And Congressman Braley gave the closing arguments to Obamacare. He said he read every single page of this bill. But what we have seen, even here in Iowa, is that it is an additional tax to Iowans and all Americans of $1.2 trillion. It is a job killer here in the state, and it's taking our personal health care decisions out of our hands and placing them in nameless, faceless bureaucrats in Washington, D.C. Just this past week, the insurance commissioner announced that plans through the exchange will go up an estimated 19%. I don't see how this is affordable for anyone when the president and Congressman Braley promised us that we would see an average reduction of $2,600 per family. Families are paying more, and they've lost their coverage.
Congressman Braley.
Senator Ernst knows that's not true. Before the Affordable Care Act went into effect, premiums in Iowa went up 25%. And she said before that every American has the right to affordable care. I agree with that, Senator Ernst, and yet 47 million Americans didn't have health insurance coverage before the Affordable Care Act was passed. I've worked with Governor Branstad to make sure that 100,000 Iowans who didn't have access to health care have it now, and that's a good thing. And we need to fix what's wrong with the Affordable Care Act and improve it. But we can't go back to the days when people were getting kicked off of health care coverage for no reason, when children with pre-existing conditions like my nephew, Tucker, who had liver cancer when he was 2 years old, would get kicked off because of pre-existing conditions, when women had to pay more for health insurance than men, when seniors paid $800 a year more for their prescription drugs. So that's why there's a big difference between where we stand and I stand with Iowans.
Now to the subject of Social Security.
May I rebut that?
15 seconds.
We still will have 31 million Americans that won't have health insurance coverage, even under Obamacare. A farm family up in north central Iowa had their policy canceled, and it has gone up. The policy they had to purchase cost $500 more a month, and now with this increase, it will be up to $600 extra a month. That's unaffordable for those families.
Congressman Braley, would you like 15 seconds?
Charles, 130,000 people like you now have affordable, quality health care coverage they didn't have before. And people used to have to go to Des Moines or Iowa City under the plan the state used to offer. Now 100,000 Iowans can go to their physician anywhere they live, and I think that's a good thing for Iowans.
Let's move on to Social Security. Ed Tibbetts with the Quad City Times has a question, and we begin for a one-minute response with Joni Ernst.
Senator Ernst, you have said that you will keep the promises to seniors now on Social Security and those nearing Social Security age, but you would look at transitioning younger workers to private accounts. How would this help with Social Security's long-term financial challenges, and why should workers who are younger, say in their 30s and 40s, be faced with going into a new system?
Thank you, Ed. I will always fight to protect Social Security and Medicare for our seniors like my parents. This is a very important issue because over 600,000 Iowans rely on Social Security. And this is a promise that has been made to those retirees and those that are nearing retirement. But we have to face the fact that Social Security is running out of funds. And within the next 20 years, if we don't do something, our retirees will see a 25% decrease in their monthly payments. But what we have to do now is look long-term and preserve Social Security for our children and grandchildren. So we have to look at many different options that are available out there, and I'm willing to look at all of those different options to find a solution except for raising the retirement age. Our seniors have worked a long time. I'm not willing to tell them they need to work another 5 or 10 years to receive benefits.
Thank you.
Congressman Braley, currently Social Security's payroll tax is capped at $117,000 in annual income. You've proposed lifting that cap, and this would mean hundreds of dollars more in taxes for people making, say, $140,000 to $150,000 a year. Won't that be a drag on the economy, especially to businesses who might rather put that money into raises for their workers?
First of all, Ed, I don't know if the score has changed, but it was 4-4 at the bottom of the eighth last I checked, so I know your Orioles are holding on. Look, sound bites have consequences, and Senator Ernst has said that she will keep her promises to seniors. And yet, when you consider privatizing Social Security and turning those investments over to risky Wall Street investment bankers, that is not protecting Social Security. So there's a very big difference between us on this issue. I think that if you are a millionaire or a billionaire, you should be paying the same percentage of your income into Social Security as a working class Iowan does. And I also think that you need to look at ways that you can put more revenue into Social Security through other means, by expanding the economy, investing in infrastructure and rebuilding our manufacturing base. And yes, increasing the minimum wage, which I support, would put billions annually into the Social Security Trust Fund. And I think that's a good thing.
Senator Ernst, you just said that you would keep all options on the table. Would you consider lifting the cap on the payroll tax on Social Security, or would you rule it out?
That is an option, and we need to sit down and discuss that, absolutely in a bipartisan manner. But raising the minimum wage is not an answer. If we raise the minimum wage, we're looking at job losses, 500,000 potential job losses across the United States, 20,000 here in the state of Iowa. And what you would bring in additional revenue for that would actually be less than 1% of the annual spending for Social Security. Security. So it doesn't shore up the system very much. It is an option. We need to discuss it. But there are a lot of options. We just need to make sure that our retirees are receiving the benefits that were promised to them.
And we'll talk more about minimum wage in just a few moments. Let's get to another viewer question here. This will be for Congressman Braley to begin. This is from a registered nurse and a mother of three girls, amongst others, that are asking, would you support background checks for all gun sales? 1 minute, please.
Well, I don't know who the registered nurse is, but absolutely. I think we should have background checks so that criminals can't buy guns. And people who are battling severe mental illness aren't able to buy guns without a background check. But Senator Ernst disagrees, and she doesn't think that, we need greater background checks that are going to protect people from being the victims of gun violence from people who shouldn't own guns. I think that people need to know where we stand on these issues. I'm a strong supporter of the Second Amendment, but the Second Amendment is like the other amendments in the Bill of Rights. It's a balance between individual liberty and the public good. And that's why it starts out in order to have a well-regulated militia. So we want to make sure that we're providing that proper balance. And I think that there's a big difference between where we stand on these issues. Senator Ernst doesn't think you should even have to go through a permit process to carry a concealed weapon, and that you should be able to take it into a bar or a church. And I think that's wrong.
Senator Ernst? 1 minute.
Yes, I am a mother of three daughters also, and any time that we hear of violence out there, it is an absolute tragedy. I am a strong supporter of the Second Amendment, and I do believe that we need to enforce the gun control laws that we have on the books right now. But there is an underlying issue that goes along with much of this gun violence, and that is of mental health. Now, I am a huge supporter of finding ways to improve our mental health system, and I have done that here in the state of Iowa with mental health reform, which allows individuals, no matter where they live, easy access to mental health care. We have 1 in 17 adults that suffer from a serious mental illness. Making sure that they have the best care possible will solve a number of these issues.
And if you have some water there, you can take a sip of it
so
while
much.
We prepare for the next topic.
You bet. Thank
this
you.
Is which we will talk about, Super PAC support. As mentioned prior to the debate, seen a couple of commercials here and there for and against each of you. Specific question on claims made against supporters and candidates for and against. Ron Steele from KWWL, Cedar Rapids, Waterloo, Iowa City, and Dubuque will begin our questioning for Congressman Braley. 1 minute, please, on the response.
Gary, thank you very much. Welcome, Congressman Braley.
Ron.
Senator Ernst, great for you to be here tonight. Much has been already said about the advertising, so I have been given the great assignment, I think, to give you a chance to refute some of these ads being the Super PAC ads particularly. These are coming millions of dollars in money coming from forces outside of Iowa. We understand those of which you have no control over at all. But they're driven by fear and scare tactics. So I'm going to begin with this one. Actually, I'm going to change my order just slightly because of the gun control that you just talked about. I heard an ad today, Congressman Braley, the NRA Political Victory Fund, insinuating that you and Michael Bloomberg are buddies now and that you're going to take away my Second Amendment rights, and I don't like it. So what's the answer?
The answer is, I've never met Michael Bloomberg. I have no idea what these ads are based upon other than a fear that I'm going to bring balanced common sense to trying to come up with reasonable solutions to reducing gun violence like I have, working with a Republican from Pennsylvania named Tim Murphy. We've held lots of hearings this year on the connection between our failure to address the needs of mental illness in this country. And through those bipartisan hearings, we learned that the largest mental health treatment facility in the United States is the Los Angeles County Jail. We know that we have to do more. And yet when Senator Ernst was asked about this question on what we can do, she was asked about her ad that she ran in the primary where she was shooting a pistol into the camera and saying, let me take aim at Obamacare. It came out right before the tragic shooting in Santa Barbara. And she was asked if she regretted it. She called it an unfortunate accident. And I don't think it was an accident to the victims and their families.
Senator?
Yes, no, that is a horrible tragedy, and I have stated that already. Now, where you have stated that you will work for mental health reform, we have actually done that here in the state of Iowa, working towards a better system and easier access for the most vulnerable in our population to receive care. They can walk into many places now and discover where they can go for treatment. Whether you're in a rural area, whether you're living in a populated area, we want to make sure that there is easy access for those that suffer from mental illness and do receive the care that they need. But I will always be a strong supporter of the Second Amendment. Our motto, state motto, our liberties we prize and our rights we will maintain.
Run.
Senator Ernst, let me ask you this. There's a new ad airing on our station the last few days. It says that you support special tax breaks for companies shipping American jobs overseas and that you would not vote to raise taxes on these companies that are doing that. So I'd like to ask you, what is the truth and what would you do to support, to keep, make sure that American companies are keeping the jobs in America and not outsourcing them to other countries overseas?
Well, we need tax reform, period, so that there aren't special loopholes for anyone out there. I do believe that Americans should be keeping more of their hard-earned paychecks in their pockets. So tax reform immediately for hardworking Americans, but over the long term, working to scrap the existing tax code and replace it with something that's fairer, flatter, and simpler. If we do that, we will be keeping American jobs here. And just as we have done here in the state of Iowa with my good friend and supporter, Terry Branstad, we have implemented a great economic plan, which includes lower taxes, the largest tax cut in Iowa history, reduced rules and regulations that kill jobs, and we've balanced the budget the last 4 years. And because of that, we have created up to 150,000 new good-paying jobs here in the state of Iowa. That's what we need to do at the federal level.
Thank you. Ron, did you have an additional question?
Congressman Braley, I'm going to give
you
a chance
to respond.
Absolutely.
May, Ron.
Yes.
Sound bites have consequences. And Senator Ernst was at the Iowa State Fair standing next to her good friend Terry Branstad when she was asked about this very issue, whether she would support changing the tax law so that those companies who ship jobs overseas wouldn't get those benefits. And she said no. That's what. Why words matter and they have consequences that are harmful to Iowans. And that's why issues matter. And talking about the consequences that issues have on Iowans matters. So Senator Ernst is fond of saying things that sound good, but when you look at what they mean to Iowans, they don't make Iowans better off. And this is another example of that. You can't say that you stand with farmers and say, I'll vote against the farm bill, that you're not a strong supporter of the renewable fuel standard because you don't agree with it in principle. And these are things that have consequences for Iowans.
In the couple of minutes that
I would like to respond to that.
15 seconds, please.
Thank you. Yes, when it comes to words and actions, actions speak louder than words. And I have a 100% rating when it comes to renewable fuels. That's from the Iowa Renewable Fuels Association. I will continue to stand up for farmers and rules. Now, I think it's very important to have farmers in the United States Senate. When you talk about your words behind closed doors at a fundraiser in Texas, you poked fun at Senator Grassley for being just a farmer without a law degree. And you have said, Congressman, that you would fight against tort reform, which is driving health care costs up for our most vulnerable Americans.
Thank you.
Well,
since we're on a war of words here.
There's been a direct attack. There's been applause. I think, Gary, that I should have an opportunity to respond.
30 seconds. Please go ahead. I'm going to remind. When we applaud, we take away time from the candidates asking these very important questions, so please be respectful of the process. Thank you.
Thank you, Gary. Senator Ernst, you know that I apologized to Senator Grassley right away. And you also know that I have supported farmers in the United States Congress by voting twice to pass a five-year farm bill. I worked 3 years to pass the last one. And I've been an outspoken champion for the renewable fuel standard. My support is strong, clear, and unequivocal, and that's why I received the endorsement of the Iowa corn growers, and that's why the National Farmers Union supports me.
In about 2 minutes that we have prior to the break, you can integrate that, if you can, into this question. A lot of viewers asking this question. Did you, Joni Ernst, sign a pledge with the Koch brothers?